Unlike my very illustrious predecessors, I shall be reading straight from my manuscript, and I've given you my whole paper, so you can just read along with me. English not being my native language, unlike those who went before me, I obviously need a little more help. So, I just want to preface this briefly by saying that presenting Paul in a setting where Revelation is discussed, I feel very honored to have been invited to this illustrious meeting. This honor can only be repaid with my respect for this organization and the people here. Thank you very much for inviting me. The paper is titled Paul, the Law and the Judgment, slightly different from what appears in the program. The purpose of this essay is to determine whether there is an exegetical basis for Ellen White's statement that justification by faith is the third angel's message in verity. This essay will address only this concern and all other concerns, pressing and tempting as they may be, will go unaddressed. There are three main sections to this essay. Before I read these sections, I'd like to say the second section, for the sake of time, will be skipped. The first section compares Revelation 14, 6 to 12, and Romans 1. This investigation seeks to determine whether there is an intertextual relationship between Revelation 14 and Romans 1. The reason for choosing Romans 1 is twofold. Romans is Paul's most lucid presentation of justification by faith. Also, there are significant verbal correlations between Revelation 14 and Romans 1 that call for investigation. In the second section, I will examine Romans 2 as a test case to see whether the concept of the gospel in Revelation 14 coincides with the concept of the gospel in Romans. Romans 2 is ideal for this purpose because it contains the most complete discussion of the law and judgment in the entire Pauline corpus. This section will be skipped, therefore you're invited to read this section on your own, at home, and please understand, I won't be there to explain it. In the final section, I will seek to clarify the role of faith, law, and judgment in Paul's thinking based on passages taken from Romans 4, 6, 7, and 14. I will conclude by answering or trying to answer possible objections to my essay, my thesis. Finally, due to space, discussion of secondary literature will be kept to a minimum. Romans 1, 14 to 32. Revelation 14, 6 to 12. One might not suspect that Revelation and Romans could have much in common. In his commentary on Revelation, David Olney states that the word gospel in Revelation 14, 6 has, quote, no semantic connections to Pauline passage, usage, unquote. Martin Luther considered Revelation neither apostolic nor prophetic. He obviously would not be a good Adventist. Indeed, for many, Revelation is a book filled with exotic imagery, symbolism, and numbers that evoke wild speculations. Certainly not here, though. It is also a book full of threats and hellfire and brimstone, and of course, and curses that are poured out without mercy upon the inhabitants of the earth to their great devastation. By contrast, Romans is a clear expression of the joyous gospel, full of grace and forgiveness. For example, Romans does not once mention the word curse in its discussion of the history of Israel's apostasy in chapters 9 to 11. A careful look, however, reveals that there is a closer affinity between Romans and Revelation than meets one at first glance. To begin with, both letters have a strong Roman connection. Revelation was sent to the seven churches on the western coast of Asia Minor facing persecution from Rome. Romans was directly sent to Rome, where nascent Christianity was struggling to take root. In other words, both letters address early Christian communities struggling to survive in the hostile environment of the empire. Most importantly, significant verbal parallels exist between Romans and Revelation. For this essay, we will limit our comparisons to Romans 1, 14 to 32, and Revelation 14, 6 to 12. The first parallel concerns the universalism of the gospel. Romans 1, 15 to 17 states, quote, "I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith," unquote. The two words in this passage that capture the universalism of Paul's gospel are "every" and "preach the gospel." The same two words appear in Revelation 14:6, also denoting the universalism of the gospel. The eternal gospel is to be preached to every nation, tribe, and tongue and people, unquote. Another eye-catching parallel is the expression "the wrath of God." In Romans 1:18, the expression "the wrath of God" describes the wrath of God being revealed from heaven against the wicked, orge theou. As a virtually identical phrase appears in Revelation 14:10, warning deluded humans about the wrath of God. And both Revelation 14 and Romans 1 describe the wrath in the context of idolatry. Romans 1:23 denounces those who exchange the glory of God for images of mortal creatures, omoiomati gonos. Revelation 14:9-11 likewise pronounces the wrath of God upon those who worship the beast and its image. The word is again, ikona avtu. Moreover, both Revelation 14 and Romans 1 directly link idolatry with immorality. In Romans 1:24-31, immorality and vices are the direct result of idolatry. In Revelation 14:8, the wine of the idolatry of Babylon is its immorality. These parallels suggest that Revelation 14 is dependent on Romans 1 for its language of judgment. The unusually large number of occurrences of the term wrath or gay in Romans and Revelation are yet another indication of literary dependence. The term orge occurs 36 times in the New Testament. Of these, 21 occurrences are in Paul, and the majority of them, 12 times, are in Romans. In other words, Paul speaks about the wrath of God more than any other New Testament writer, and fully one-third of the occurrences of orge are found in Romans. Remarkably, Revelation has the next largest occurrence of the term in the New Testament, 6 times. If we add the verb to be angry or gizomai, which does not occur in Paul, to the list, then the total occurrence of wrath in Revelation comes to 8. One asks, is it possible that Paul's gospel is the source of the language and concept of the wrath of God in Revelation? The answer is yes. This is further evident from the way Romans 1 and Revelation 14 use the term glory, doxa. Both chapters use doxa to underscore the importance of renouncing idolatry and of recognizing God as the sole creator of the world. Romans 1:21-23 condemns the human refusal to give glory to Creator God. And the resultant idolatry that exchanges the glory of God for images resembling creatures. Similarly, Revelation 14:7-10 calls upon humans to give glory to God and to avoid the image of the beast. In other words, to renounce idolatry. In Jewish monotheism, the worship of Creator God and the rejection of idolatry are, as it were, the two sides of the same coin. And it appears that Revelation 14:7-10 is the obverse of Romans 1:18-23. Romans 1 denounces idolatry and Revelation 14 extols the creator, worship of Creator God. What needs to be noted here, however, is that doxa is a theological term bearing Paul's own unique stamp. As Robert W. Yarborough rightly notes, the noun doxa occurs 77 times in Paul and figures very prominently in his theology. One particularly interesting occurrence of a Pauline term in Revelation is the word mind, nous. Except for its one occurrence in Luke 24:45, the Greek word nous, or mind, occurs in the New Testament only in Paul and Revelation. It occurs a whopping 21 times in Paul and twice in Revelation. In Paul, nous, or the mind, is a human faculty that enables one to discern the will of God morally and in the events taking place in history. Thus, Romans 12:2 states, quote, "Be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God." Metamorphoste ti anankesnosi tu nos. What is good and acceptable and perfect? Unquote. The nous is also the faculty that enables a person to acknowledge and worship Creator God. The reason for idolatry, then, for Paul, is that idolaters have a degenerate nous. Paul states in Romans 1:28, quote, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and to improper conduct." And there you can see the word for mind is a dokimon nun, unquote. Interestingly, the two occurrences of nous in Revelation bear more than a passing resemblance to these uses of nous in Paul. Revelation 13:8 states, quote, "This calls for wisdom. Let him who has a mind, o echon nun, count the number of the beast." Unquote. And again, Revelation 17:9 states, quote, "This calls for a mind with wisdom, o deo nous, o echon sophian," unquote. The word nous, or mind, in these two passages denotes a renewed human faculty that enables one to discern the identity of the beast and its immoral and impious schemes. Mutatis mutandis, this means possessing a renewed mind is essential to faith because it enables one to recognize the true worship of Creator God and to avoid idolatry. This unusual term, at least for the New Testament, appearing in Paul and Revelation, in approximately the same sense and context, clearly suggests literary dependence. In this context, it is difficult to miss the clear Pauline echo in Revelation 14:12. Quote, "Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus," unquote. This phrase, "the faith of Jesus," is nearly identical to the phrase "the faith of Jesus Christ" in Galatians 2:16, and certainly echoes the verbal phrase "we have believed in Jesus Christ, imis is Christon Jesun epistevsamen," unquote. The ambiguity, however, that beclouds the Pauline phrase, whether it is an objective or a subjective genitive, also beclouds John's usage. This discussion, however, lies outside the scope of this essay. For our purposes, suffices to say merely two things. Number one, in Revelation 14:12, the quintessential Pauline phrase, "the faith of Jesus," appears together with the phrase "the commandments of God" as a direct object of the verb terrain, to keep. And number two, this unique and vague phrase appears nowhere else in the New Testament except in Paul and Revelation 14:12. By using the phrase as the direct object of the verb to keep in conjunction with the law of God, Revelation 14:12 appears to treat the faith of Jesus, like the law, as something to keep and to fulfill. A similar usage of faith is found in 2 Timothy 4:7. Quote, "I have kept the faith, din pistin te dirika." These parallels seem to suggest that Revelation 14 is intentionally trying to engage Romans 1 in order to make a statement about Paul's gospel. In Revelation 14:6-12, the gospel has three basic characteristics. Number one, divine judgment forms an integral part of the gospel. That's in verses 6b to 7a. Number two, the proper response to the proclamation of the gospel is fearing God and giving glory to Him as the creator of the world. Number three, the law has an active role alongside faith in the life of a Christian. The question is whether these notions are consistent with Paul's concept of the gospel, particularly as articulated in Romans. So at this point, I want to digress from literary comparisons to the conceptual comparisons. Now I'll skip section 2 and go to your page number 9, and I pick up where it says law, judgment, and faith. Law, judgment, and faith. According to Paul, one of the functions of the law is to cause humans to experience condemnation before God. Romans 3:19-20 clarifies this function of the law. Quote, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God, to theo. For no human being will be justified in his sight, en opion aftu, by works of the law, since through the law comes knowledge of sin." The problem of the Jews was not that they possessed the law or that they tried to keep it. Rather, their problem, as far as Paul was concerned, was that the way they kept the law and reasoned about it prevented them from recognizing that they were in fact breaking the law and at the same time failing to experience the terror of God's impartial judgment. When Paul makes statements like, quote, "through the law comes knowledge of sin," unquote, in Romans 3:20, or, quote, "the law came in to increase the trespass," unquote, Romans 5:20, his intent is not to demean the law. His point, rather, is that if the law had been allowed to function as originally intended by God, it would have given the people the to theo, or the before God experience, described in Romans 3:19-20. And this experience would have removed boasting from them, leaving them condemned before God without excuse. Therefore, Paul's aim in Romans 1-3 is to explain the law in such a way that it is allowed to fulfill its intended function, which is to bring sinners before God, face to face, to receive condemnation. In this light, it is noteworthy that Paul creates an inclusio in Romans 3:11 and 3:18, with quotations that define sin as a failure to seek God's presence. In verse 11, he quotes from Psalm 14, quote, "No one understands, no one seeks for God," unquote. This quotation would no doubt have caused an informed reader, such as you, to recall the opening words of Psalm 14 itself, quote, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God," unquote. A similar quote closes the catena of scriptural quotations that follow the opening charge, quote, "There is no fear of God before their eyes," unquote. The refusal to acknowledge God as God is the essence of sin. And it is in just such terms that Paul portrays human sinfulness in Romans 1-3. The pagan, the judgmental person in 2:1-11, whoever they are, and the Jew, they all have in common their desire to depart from the presence of God and give glory to themselves. Therefore, a sinner can fulfill the law only by fulfilling its original intention, which is to stand before God, to theo, and face judgment. Remarkably, Paul uses the same totheo language to describe faith. According to Romans 4:2, Abraham had nothing to boast about before God. Prosteon. Instead, he was justified because he had faith in the presence of God. Episteusin Abraham, totheo. Paul repeats the same point in verse 17. God in whose presence he believed, katenantiou epistephsin theou. And in verse 20, quote, "He grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, dous doxan to theou," unquote. Clearly, Abraham's faith The yardstick by which we are to measure our own is consistently described in Romans 4 as a totheo experience, an experience of existing in the presence of God. In other words, faith and the law have essentially the same spiritual structure. They both demand that we exist before God, the Creator, whose judgment knows no partiality. Romans 6:11 states, quote, "You must consider yourselves dead to sin, te hamartia, and alive to God, to theo, in Christ Jesus," unquote. Here Paul uses the word sin in the same personal sense as God. It is even clearer in verse 13, quote, "Do not yield your members to sin, te hamartia, as instruments of wickedness, but yield yourselves to God, to theo," unquote. As indicated by the precise juxtaposition of to sin and to God in these verses, the opposite of the presence of God is the presence of sin, whose wicked whims control human existence. Faith denotes the life of one who has been judged before the judgment seat of an impartial God and set free from the grips of sin to enjoy life in God's presence. The totheo language appears again in 7:4. Quote, "We may bear fruit to God, karpophorisomen totheo," unquote. This time, however, the contrast is between totheo and to nomo. Quote, "You have died to the law, ethanatothite to nomo," unquote. Then in 7:6, further contrast totheo with to thanato. Quote, "Our bodily members bear fruit for death." The existence away from the presence of God described in Romans 6 and 7 may be given in the chart that I give you there, and you may study this. These three presence of sin in the presence of the law, presence of death, these depictions of sinful existence closely resemble the depictions of sin and human rebellion in chapters 1 to 3. In chapters 6 to 7, the totheo language used opposite the three modes of existence under sin define faith as a life lived before God. In Romans 14, Paul again takes up the totheo language, as it were, in a grand finale. Paul declares in chapter 6, quote, "A person who eats before the Lord, curio este, for they offer thanks to God, evcharistei kar to theo," unquote. The anathros kurios in this verse appears to reflect the translation of the tetragrammaton Yahweh in the Septuagint. Similar usage of the totheo language occur throughout the chapter. I give you the verses there, evoking the Old Testament phrase, lifne Adonai, before the Lord. In the Old Testament, the expression lifne Adonai is used to designate the entirety of life lived before God, privately, collectively, and cultically. Likewise, for Paul, living by faith means that we exist lifne Adonai, whether we eat, drink, or rest. The judgment language of Romans 14, 10-12 highlights this meaning of faith. Quote, "We all stand before the judgment seat of God," unquote. And, quote, "Each of us shall give account of himself to God, to theo," unquote. These descriptions of faith as a life under judgment are remarkably similar to those that describe the life under the law. What is Paul's point? Faith and law basically operate under the same spiritual principle in the life of a believer. Both faith and law cause people to live and die lifne Adonai before the Lord. The prospect of judgment continues for those who live by faith. As for those who are under the law, not only as a future judgment, future event, but as a reality to be reckoned with on a daily, if not hourly, basis. The difference is that acquitted, the people of faith boldly approach the throne of grace. Jewett Bassler rightly notes, quote, "The impartiality of the new dispensation of grace, which is open to all without distinction, is consistent with, even grounded in, the impartiality of the judgment," unquote. The present tense verbs in 14:8 denote this ongoing reality of divine judgment and acquittal in the life of a believer. To kyrio zomen, to kyrio apotoniskomen. This understanding of faith seems to echo the Psalms that express an ardent desire to behold the face of God. In Romans 14:12-23, Paul ends the chapter on the note of faith with the significant undertone of the Toseo language. He writes, quote, "Hast thou faith? Have it to thyselves before God and opium to Theo." Unquote. This statement, as it were, sums up the Toseo principle of faith, repeatedly outlined in chapters 4, 6, and 7. There are only two ways of life, two ways to live a life in the presence of God or away from it. Paul writes, quote, whatever does not proceed from the faith is sin. Faith means a life intentionally lived in the presence of God. Conversely, the opposite of faith is forgetfulness that keeps the fear of God's judgment out of one's life and out of one's consciousness. Therefore, I submit that the proper response of the gospel given in Revelation 14:7 is a rather accurate summary of Paul's understanding of faith expressed in Romans. Living by faith means A, to fear God and give glory to Him, like Abraham, who is an impartial judge of all humankind, and B, to worship God, who is creator of the world. Now I'd like to answer some of the possible objections and questions to my interpretation. Due to space, I will only deal with four of the objections, one of which I will not read today, because it deals with section 2. Number 1, my concept of judgment is too individualistic. Number 2, my reading of Romans is too dependent on anti-rights argument. Number 3, my reading will foster petty legalism and self-centered introspection. And number 4, my reading takes away from the centrality of Christ and turns faith into human performance. I will take up these objections one at a time. First, any discussion about judgment implies a cosmic, apocalyptic, and prophetic perspective that addresses issues like theodicy and justice. I do not wish to deny this. My intent in this essay has been simply to show that Paul's concept of faith exists in inseparable relation to judgment, however one defines it. Move down to the third. While it is true that my exposition of the gospel fosters introspection, it does not necessarily lead to petty legalism or self-centeredness. The before God character of faith preempts the possibility of legalism in that no one needs to answer to anyone else except to God whether one has kept the law. Legalism is a product of judgmentalism that causes people to measure themselves against each other. Being no respecter of persons, God will judge everyone based on His, meaning God's, standards. As for introspection, for many, faith means saying goodbye to the feelings of uncertainty as something characterizing the existence under the law. Faith means an assurance of salvation free from all doubts. Paul would agree that faith does not breed doubts. But he would not agree that faith frees you from having to look inside yourself and at God's judgment in trying to determine whether your actions, your behavior, that is, are just, whether they accord with the will of God. This is clear from Romans 14, 12 to 23. Paul writes, quote, "Happy is he who has no reason to judge himself for what he approves. But he who has doubts is condemned." According to this passage, a believer engages in private and personal judiciary activities that experiences that result in either approval or disapproval of his own actions. The experiences of inner conflict arising from these activities and the joyful experience of the gospel are necessarily coterminous. Faith that causes people to live before God also allows them to enjoy the power of personal agency to make even difficult ethical decisions by themselves and for themselves. This is the new covenant. The notion that faith offers an assurance that precludes the fear of judgment and accountability is a gospel unknown to Paul. In this light, Christopher Standel's charge that the notion of introspective conscience was introduced to Western Christianity by Augustine and Martin Luther needs a fresh examination. Due to the scope of this paper, only a few brief comments are possible. This is only for those who are concerned about his thesis. I'm sure experts are here. Standall is probably right in his observation that Paul has, quote, a rather robust conscience, unquote. At the same time, a robust conscience does not preclude introspection. The various Greek schools of philosophy were nothing if they were not about introspection. They were deeply involved in what Stanley Stores calls, quote, the technology of the self, unquote, through which they try to carefully map out the inner knowledge or workings of the human mind and body to foster self-improvement and perfection. Stendhal is himself unduly influenced by Augustine and Luther when he equates introspection with, quote, troubled conscience, unquote. As we saw for Paul, introspection is synonymous with the personal agency and accountability of the individual, expressing inwardness and freedom enjoyed under the new covenant. Finally, my understanding of the gospel does not need to undermine the centrality of Christ. The law plays a hermeneutical role, by no means the only one it plays. One cannot understand the true meaning of faith without the belief that the law is the norm of judgment. Almost every mention of faith in Paul presupposes an understanding of law and judgment. Judgment by law based on performance is the default procedure by which one is declared righteous. Justification by faith is an exception made to this rule, an eschatological surprise. The cross graciously opened up the unexpected kairos of the opportunity for salvation. We cannot fully appreciate this unexpected nature of grace without the default of judgment by law. Furthermore, the Pauline gospel does not preempt the need for human performance. A new covenant experience that excludes ethical responsibility is an oxymoron. N.T. Wright bifurcates when he states in the same breath that the keeping of the law is, quote, in tune with Ezekiel 36, unquote, and, quote, it is a matter not of ethics, but of status, unquote. As a new covenant experience, the gospel represents the higher expectation of righteousness articulated in the Sermon on the Mount and Paul's own paranesis. If the letters of Paul are any indication of his gospel, then we must say that the gospel is just as much a demand for ethical purity and accountability as it is a proclamation of grace. To be judged according to the gospel means to be judged according to the new covenant that promises and expects the law to be written on our hearts. In Romans 8, 3-4, Paul states that through Christ's death, the law is fulfilled in us. In 13:8, Paul states that love fulfills the law. The two foci of accountability before God under the law, the fear of God's judgment and the worship of the Creator of God, remains unchanged under faith. Certainly, salvation is by faith. But the fulfillment of the law is not optional for Christians. The business of being a Christian is about fulfilling the moral and ethical demands of the law before God and before our fellow humans. In conclusion, then, the apocalyptic delineations of the gospel found in Revelation 14:6-12 are consistent with Paul's concept of the gospel in Romans. And it appears that the third angel's message is indeed the message of righteousness by faith in verity.